Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Truth of Happiness Dhamma study Sangha discussion on the five clinging aggregates and Dhamma talk that introduces the ninth week study of Karma and Rebirth. This was recorded on February 18th, 2017 at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So this past week you studied the second half of the chapter on understanding not-self, the five clinging aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness rooted in ignorance. So I'd like to hear how you relate these teachings, five clinging aggregates, to the Four Noble Truths, how that relates to suffering, and also how it relates to dependent origination. I got a question from a student a couple days ago about this, and he was wondering that same thing. He kind of gets dependent origination. He understands five clinging aggregates, but how do they fit together? So the brief explanation that I gave, and we're going to have a phone conversation, is dependent origination explains how from ignorance suffering arises. And the five clinging aggregates is the vehicle for that personal experience of suffering. So let's see what you think, what you do with that. Laura, good to see you this morning.
It was good to be here. I think for me anyway, the five clinging aggregates are a little more tangible to, you know, dependent origination. They do feel like I can actually have an experience of them in a given moment. Let's see. For example, this morning, my children's slept at my mother-in-law's because we've had family in town, and I went over there to see if I could bring my brother-in-law up here, but he was sound asleep when I came to pick him up, and my children were all watching television, and I'm a no screen mom, so it gets me. It's the stress when I see them viewing cartoons. So I, you know, immediately, you know, recognize as I was thinking about the five clinging aggregates as I was driving over there this morning, you know, the outward form of what I see my kids are watching. Like, that's the visual I'm getting. And then immediately, you know, microseconds later, I have this feeling that arises, and my perceptions from that and my mental fabrications from that, whether they're true or not, it doesn't matter. And I just find that, you know, my awareness of remembering the Four Noble Truths, and that this is just this ongoing process, you know, that's happening all the time, and this just happens to be a strong stressor for me, so it's very apparent that my consciousness then can shift from, you know, into the consciousness of recognizing the truths, the Four Noble Truths in that moment, instead of reacting, you know, to my kids saying, "What are you watching? Like, why did you put this on?" Whatever things I could go into that would be wrong speech. So then the Eightfold Path kind of comes in as well. So I can kind of just, through the consciousness of that particular experience, I can then decide consciously how I'm going to use my words and what. So that's, I just recognized that this morning as this way of viewing any given situation in using the aggregates to kind of dissect it a little bit. Dependent origination kind of is sort of this, you know, it feels like more of a study. Like, this is like, I can really see it happen, but dependent origination, I have to, like, go back and, like, view it and then pull it apart and see what happened, and it's more of a mental exercise than kind of the, anyway. Here I am.
I'm glad you, that was a perfect explanation of that process. And yeah, the five clinging aggregates are the personal experience of dependent origination. So, and you understand that. And so in that context, dependent origination is more of an intellectual look at the Dhamma, where understanding the five clinging aggregates is a personal experience of the nature of suffering. And what a great example of walking into a room and seeing your kids watching cartoons. And I'm thinking about all these violent cartoons. They were probably watching something pleasant, but I'm thinking back to, yeah, to the Roadrunner dropping rocks on something. I wonder what effect that's had on me. but you observed the process, and you were able to pause the reaction, which is exactly why we do this. That's the level of refined mindfulness that is framed by the Eightfold Path. So it's a reasonable concern for anyone to have of their children watching cartoons. Of course, the middle way is kids are going to probably watch cartoons occasionally, and it's not the worst thing in the world. But to have that concern is a skillful concern. It's not something that we shouldn't have, but it's how we react to it. And that's exactly how you describe. You were able to control your mind. Another way of saying that, you were able to maintain your mindfulness. You didn't lose your mind over the situation. That's exactly how it works. So, good for you, and thank you for sharing that. Jen, good morning. Good to see you.
Good to see you. I didn't read the chapter. I remembered last night at like 10 o'clock at night. I was like, oh no, I didn't do my homework. The second half, I read the first half last week, but I've always had this question kind of bouncing around in my head, and I was going to ask it today, and it's basically the question that your student asked, and maybe if I'd read the second half, I would know the answer. But I've always kind of just filed away the 12 causative links the five clinging aggregates as like an abbreviated version of the 12 causative links somehow. I knew that that wasn't totally right, but I kind of just put it aside because I knew that I kind of wasn't getting it totally. So my question was, I was going to actually ask you, you know, how those two things kind of specifically go together. And I keep reading the 12 causative links, and it has the same words as the five clinging aggregates, which is why, and this is a very cerebral approach, obviously, but that's why I feel like it's just kind of an abbreviated version of it. But I also can see how dependent origination and 12 causative links sort of leads to the explanation you gave, leads to the five clinging aggregates or this like maintained ego conditioning.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's also happening in every moment.
An ongoing process.
Yeah. Right. So I still feel like they're the same. Are they the same thing?
In one sense, they are.
Yeah.
The five clinging aggregates are the experience of the culmination of the process rooted in ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, you can say it's the same thing. Sometimes a problem comes between, there's not a direct linear correlation between ignorance, mental fabrication, consciousness, and the five clinging aggregates. They're categorized differently. So the five clinging aggregates, the way that the Pali word for that is skanda or kanda, which points to a heap. So this is a heap of these things that are just kind of piled together,
mm-hmm,
where dependent origination breaks it out a little bit more in a little bit more detailed way. So again, dependent origination explains in an intellectual way what we are experiencing as five clinging aggregates. Remember that the experience of five clinging aggregates, the experience of anatta, is rooted in ignorance. And the way that our minds work, we want to create something permanent and substantial, even though the teachings are showing us that nothing here is permanent and substantial, meaning that we want to take that bias and apply it to these teachings. Dependent origination states something that is always in a process of becoming, rooted in ignorance. The five clinging aggregates is what has become of that ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
Yeah, and I think I'm also forgetting about the truth, so I think about that, and that part has to be integrated.
Yeah, it's so important.
Yeah.
So these aren't... this isn't a way of explaining everything in the universe, or it's not a creation myth. It's simply teaching us that because of ignorance, because of individual ignorance of the true nature of reality, meaning Four Noble Truths, because of that initial ignorance, we create ignorance. The fabrications are dependent on initial ignorance. And so every fabrications are assumptions about ourselves in relation to the world. So everything that follows from that ignorance is going to be rooted in ignorance, which doesn't diminish the hold that it has on us, but it does explain that there's really nothing there. And again, you look at when you separate, when you stop clinging together form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness, then we are able to experience life as it occurs to each one of those aggregates without using the aggregates to say, oh, there's a self there, there's me. Because all of those aggregates are part of that ongoing process. None of them are permanent. Like it says up there, like we talked about on the retreat, we'll talk about it again this year. Whatever is impermanent, that cannot describe me. This is not me. Whatever impermanence is prone to suffering, that cannot be me. The five clinging aggregates are all impermanent. They do not describe a self. And the only usefulness of them, the only reason the Buddha taught that, is because we take these disparate, impermanent objects, we cling them together through experience, rooted in ignorance, to say, oh, well, there's the self. There I am. And at any point that you do that, you're creating a delusion in your mind because there's no fixed me. It's really the underlying message that the Buddha was teaching. And there's no point in your physical or emotional life that you can say, there I am. But what you can understand is that what we call ourselves, what I call me, is always in a process of becoming. And so if I engage in a process that's rooted in ignorance, it can only end up in confusion, delusion, and suffering. But if I develop the true wisdom of understanding the nature of the world, then I can understand that each moment I'm contributing to my own experience. There's nothing arbitrary about what I'm experiencing. When I understand the nature of my own reacting mind, then I can stop it. And it's just as Laura described, it's just that simple and direct, but we have to be aware of what's going on. So if I can use you as an example, you seize the opportunity in that moment to either react and create, this relates directly to what we're going to talk about in a minute, to either react and create further confusion, delusion, and suffering for everyone involved.
Yes, which I have done.
Which we all have done, which the Buddha recognizes the common human problem. And he taught a way that we can brilliantly, through mindfulness, interrupt that process and not react, not create further confusion, delusion for ourselves and everyone else contemporaneously. And so, I'll tie in today's talk a little bit, and so to diminish the ongoing process of karma showing us our own ignorance. And so that is really how it works. These somewhat conceptual applications, certainly the five clinging aggregates are conceptual when we first hear it, but when we finally understand it, it's entirely practical. There's no concept involved in it. We understand it at that level. That, yeah, this is just what's occurring. And so when a reaction in my mind, when I see Laura's kids watching cartoons, I know they're not supposed to, I can recognize that process that used to occur in me, hopefully, and I'm no longer going to react. I'm not going to lose my mind over this situation. I'm not going to allow this thing that is prone to reaction, meaning clinging these things together and describing me, And when I separate them, when I release those beliefs from clinging, there's nothing left to react. There's no fixed self. There's no, to use Laura, there's no Laura the mom anymore. There's just Laura the mom being present with what's occurring. Why react to it? Why get upset? And again, this relates to everything in our life. The other thing, the other side of that would be desire. It's not just reaction. You see something that really grabs your eye and that you want to create an identity over. This is mine. You've just created you've just established another point of suffering and confusion for you because you've created an identity over it, rather than recognizing the attraction.
I think that those stronger desires or aversions are like just a real opportunity to explore this process.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, there's, you know, again, it's occurring in every moment, but some of these moments are just so subtle. We have like a non, you've said it before. It's neither an aversion or a
desire.
It's whatever is in the middle of it, but we're still like, creating, there's still a creation of this I making in these moments,
yeah,
that we kind of aren't aware of. So just these, I feel like it's like the stronger reaction, the more of this, the feeling of this clinging or this tightening, the more there's this opportunity to really have that experience of the five clinging aggregates.
Yeah, and understand that this is not me, this is not mine. Why? Because it's impermanent. You know, that, why would you want to establish yourself by clinging to something that is impermanent or ever-changing, including that simple desire? There's things that we all can look back in our lives and look at things that at one point we thought were most important to us and we had to have them in order to be happy, and now we don't care. You know, but more than likely, we've attached ourselves to other things that we're using to define our happiness by. And again, that points to the impermanent nature of all things. If we accept the fact that everything in our entire experience is always changing, and then apply that through a well-concentrated mind rooted in meditation and framed by the Eightfold Path, then we recognize how important that understanding is. What is impermanent cannot be me. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. And that anytime we attach ourselves to anything that's impermanent, it's rooted in a lack of understanding, it's rooted in deluded thinking and confused thinking, and it can only lead to more stress in our lives. But to recognize that process as it's occurring is the essence of the Dhamma, which you did. And it relates directly to your question about that. So dependent origination is the intellectual explanation of how suffering arises. The five clinging aggregates is the personalization of that suffering. Boy, great discussion already. Jay, good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. I want to kind of keep my comments brief because I'm fascinated by what take you might have on reincarnation on a practical way as it affects our study and your idea of Buddhism or whatever. So I don't want to say too much, but I did find some tidbits in the reading that I thought brought me some clarity. One was about your karma is your dukkha, or vice versa. I guess it works either way. The other thing that I picked up was that sometimes when you have very good intentions, you can still really screw things up and have a bad effect. I have a demonstration of how that happened to me this week, but again, I want to kind of keep comments short to leave you more time, because, you know, later on. And the aggregates to me are the effects of the material world. That's how I read it, you know, various as they might be. And last of all is if you watch kids' cartoons for a few minutes, you get two immediate thoughts. One is that there are still people who are taking hallucinogens, and the other is that we're going to hell in a handbasket. Because they're really, really weird. They're not just the roadrunner, you know, dropping a safe on them. It's much worse. It's much more insidious and scary.
Yeah.
Is it really? Well, I don't like to associate with those types of things, but I'm going to have to watch some cartoons again.
I can go on about it.
Get the modern take on it.
Hey, you're doing a good job as a mom if you're keeping them away from the tube, because nobody kept me away, and look what a mess it made of me. Maybe a smart ass. All those Bugs Bunny cartoons, I thought that's what you're supposed to be like.
Oh, yeah.
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 Very bad.
It's really wild, isn't it? That's my favorite.
But if we even put that in perspective,
yeah.
Cartoons are part of the first noble truth. You know, they are. And we all survived from it too, but that's not to say maybe we all would have been better off without it. But there it is. It's all part of the world.
You know?
Interesting, though, when you're not getting off to it, that at least from when I used to watch cartoons when I was a kid, that they really were geared towards violence,
mm-hmm.
and they were produced for children.
That's just
a strange mm-hmm. thing.
I remember
but,
always being told, like, this is so mean. Why is the Red River so mean? It's Tom. Why is Jerry so mean to Tom?
Because of craving and clinging. If they only had just a little bit of Buddhist teachings right at the end of it, probably would have been helpful.
Yeah.
Positive because of the classical music that Warner Brothers played for the
That's right, yeah.
And then as I grew up and I would hear the music, I'd go, wow, that's from Bugs Bunny, you know? And really, a lot of music, jazz music.
That's true.
That was all the background. That's what I got was music.
There's some usefulness even in that, too, so. Well, I will talk about reincarnation today. I'll talk about it in just a minute. Thank you, Jack. Kevin, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to see you. Good. I guess one thing I think it just as an offshoot of everything else is the clinging. I think the word clinging in that is so important, and that really relates to the Four Noble Truths. Because the clinging is what leads to and perpetuates dukkha.
Yep.
And if clinging can be erased, and it is a very difficult thing to let go of that clinging. I think in some ways it might be easy to give up clinging to things. Material things, or foods, or alcohol, or certain things, but then letting go of the clinging to the self is a very difficult thing because we were brought up to cherish the self and to build the self. And we talked about it in our talk on Thursday about fear in meditation, that it almost seems like there. If you lose the self, then there's an annihilation of the self, and that's a very fearful, fearsome thing.
Yeah.
So, and it's, I think it's the clinging maybe to the self and maybe to the people closest to you, that if you enter too deeply into the not-self, maybe you will lose those people, or they're clinging to you, they won't know what to cling to anymore. And then that can cause more distress for oneself and for those people, and you don't want to put that on people. So it's to be this big heap.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of more and more. And it's very, and just starting out with this, it becomes a kind of a fearsome thing. So that's one thing. And the other is a kind of interesting paradox to me, that the five clinging aggregates sound so similar to me to the four foundations of mindfulness.
Right.
It's almost like they're the same thing, but you have to turn them inside out. To have mindfulness, they're almost the same kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
but you need to use them to become mindful, but you also need to stop clinging to become mindful. It's a really fascinating paradox.
Yeah.
That's the way I see it. I don't know. Reading too much into it.
Oh, I don't think you are. Overall, everything the Buddha taught was specifically for developing understanding of the nature of suffering and our contributions of suffering. The four foundations of mindfulness is primarily taught to recognize that process during meditation. But what are we bringing to meditation? We're bringing the five clinging aggregates. And so the four foundations of mindfulness begins with that first aggregate, even though they're not linear, a form. We're sitting with our form. And the foundation of mindfulness is feelings arise. But in that sense, feelings mean any type of movement in the mind, any type of agitation is a feeling in that sense. And so that directly relates to what's occurring in this thing called the five clinging aggregates. Getting back to what you said, that and relating to what we talked about Thursday night in class, about fear arising and the understanding at first of clinging to external objects and events. That's the gross beginning understanding of this process. And as we deepen our process, we realize that what we're really attached to is views of self. And that's where annihilation and anxiety can really come in, because it feels like annihilation. If I let go of these views, when you're using the views to describe yourself, even if those views are rooted in ignorance, that's all you have. And so as you're looking at these views and you're starting to let go of them, or hoping to let go of them, it does feel like, well, what's going to be left? And then that relates to how you feel other people are relating to you. If I let go of all sense of a self-referential ego self, how is anybody going to relate to me? Well, the Buddha did the same thing, and people walk for thousands of miles to get to be in his presence. What happens when you let go of all self-referential views is you're much more present in a meaningful way with the people around you. But again, think about the ego putting up that block. Well, if you let go of me, nobody's going to want you. That's just another self-referential view. But it's so easy to get caught up in that. You know, this kind of relates to the Ratana Sutta and taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. To me, the most loving and compassionate human being that ever lived was the Buddha. Why? Because he was completely devoid of any type of clinging, meaning self-referential clinging. So, again, and the Buddha described awakening in very simple terms, released or unbound from clinging. Nothing magical or mystical or esoteric or anything related to, you know, future achievements. You're living a fully human a fully human life free of clinging. That's an awakened human being. And if you think about what we really all want from the minute we're born, even though we get lost in all the other things that we think are important, it's to live life with peace and happiness. What the Buddha discovered is the only way to do that is to be free of clinging. And when he described clinging, he described it as birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what is desired is suffering. Being separated from those that are loved is suffering. So even that concern can come up. What happens if I develop this path all the way? I might be separated from those that I love. Of course, that's not true. You'd be able to be much more present. But it feels like that. It feels like you're letting go of everything. The models, and they're practical models too, of people going off into caves and meditating for years and years and years is an outward expression of attempting to do that inwardly. And I'm not saying that there's not value in doing that. But the process, whether you're in a cave or sitting in a room off your living room, is exactly the same process. And the results can be the same. We can create that experience of refuge in a cave in our own minds, in our own lives, living a human life involved with the world. It may be more difficult in some ways, but in some ways I don't think it is. I think that we really need, once we've developed the framework of the Eightfold Path, our interaction with the outside world is so valuable in showing us where our craving and clinging arises. And you can really distort that if you remove yourself too much from the world. And again, that's not to say that there's not individuals that achieve great understanding doing that. But that process and the necessity of a solitary practice is so important. But if with the right practice and the right mindfulness, then the entire world, in other words, off our cushion, becomes the process of awakening. You know, because we can see it. It's much more helpful that way. And that's not to say that, you know, a monastic life is not an important life. It may be a quicker path for some, but it's not the only path. We can do this. We can do this in this life, in our lives, with our families, with our attachments. Recognize them and let them go. You know, and then you're here in a much more meaningful way. Thank you, Kevin. Eva, good morning. Good to see you.
I'm confused. I usually, when I've gotten to the dependent origination part of the book and what follows, I get to kind of stop. I read it and I kind of just try to absorb it. I find that again, the Buddha, whatever, was very profound in his knowledge, because I find that when I have a question, then I find another aspect that you presented in the book that sort of explains it, and so that gives me satisfaction to get through the confusion. But right now, I think what I'm most realizing is there's so much dukkha. There's just so much, and I've got lots of ignorance, and I can't. I'm kind of realizing that, okay, I got all these tools, and I'm trying to chip away, but it just doesn't seem to be making an impact. And sometimes I guess it's just how I feel in general. Some days it feels like, okay, I got it, and then other days I feel like I don't. And it's just, you get to that point where it's like, well, you know, I'm just tired of trying. I just want to go to sleep and not wake up for a month. But of course it will all still be there. And it's not anything, you know. I mean, there are a lot of big things going on in the world, and yes, it's that weight, but it's, I don't even know. It's just this trying, and then at the end I'm going to end up with nothing. You know, I mean, I'm not going to end up with me, you know. It's all I got. So that's just it.
Thank you. So it's just like that. Even in Dhamma practice, dukkha occurs. Sometimes we want to take a whole month off and just go to sleep and not even think about this, and you can, but right effort is there for exactly that reason. Something the Buddha recognized was a common human tendency to just not want to keep doing this even after we've begun. So what do? You persevere. The Pali word is kshanti. It means patient perseverance. Patient meaning with ourselves. Even when I don't feel like it, don't judge yourself harshly. I know you've heard me say it. This is a path of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. You know, there's going to be times when coming up against our own contributions to dukkha and realizing that those are the exact things that I have to let go of, it's tough. We don't want to, and it feels like annihilation. It feels like, what happens? Of course, again, that's getting back to the Ratana Sutta and taking refuge in the idea that a human being actually did this and lived the most effective, and other people too. I mean, the Pali Canon has many, many stories of people that awakened and how effective their lives were. Anatha Pandika, who was a very wealthy businessman at the time of the Buddha, and rather, I don't know if I want to use the word corrupt, but I can't think of a better word, rather corrupt in his business dealings, but that was common at the time. It was everybody for themselves. He took to the Buddha's Dhamma. He awakened. He didn't stop being a businessman. In fact, it was because he continued practicing business, engaging in commerce, but framed by the Eightfold Path, that the Buddha and his Sangha was able to survive all those years. He used his money, gave a lot of it to the Buddha and to his Sangha. He set up Jita's Grove that the Buddha used for at least 3 months of the year, but sometimes they stayed there all year round, continuously throughout his life. So it can feel like we're going to lose ourselves, but really all that we're gaining is a mindful presence of our life as our life unfolds. And we're much more effective to the people around us. Now, as far as the details, all the things that seem to come down on us all at once at times, that's all an aspect of the First Noble Truth too. It's meaning it's part of living in the world. We can't control the timing of events and things all that well, can we? But what we can control is spoken of in the second noble truth. Craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. So if I'm craving for my life to be different than it is in relation to the outer world, and there's many things that I have no control over, they're just worldly causes and conditions, the Dhamma tells me that I have to cease insisting that they be different than they are, and then with my refined mindfulness, just do the best I can in my life. All of us have demands on us. I mean, unless you're really living in a cage. If you're living in the world, no matter who you are, you have constant demands on your time. Some are more than others. When you have three kids and a husband and other things going on, it seems more intense. But we all have situations where we're always being pulled to do something, and usually it's more than we're really capable of doing. What do? The best thing we can do is to take that refuge of our meditation practice a few times a day and just get away from it. Just for a few minutes. Get away from it, maintain our concentration, maintain our refined mindfulness, and then we can give birth to another mindful moment, which I'll talk about in just a minute. So, thank you. Debbie, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to see you, too. Well, what's interesting is I came with the same question that your student and Jen came, you know, kind of confused about the differences. I feel like Laura's examples for the whole putting it into practice or the experience was really helpful to kind of answer some of that. And I'm amazed at how where you integrated that. I mean, I'm nowhere near that in terms of understanding how that integrates into a situation of five aggregates. You know, I feel like just such a newborn with all this still.
Retreat.
Right.
Yeah.
Retreat.
Wait, coming up.
What'd you say?
To go, come on the retreat.
Oh, yeah. Very helpful. So, but everything everybody says is helpful, and forgot other things I was going to say. You know, I just have to keep reading and practicing. I felt like I went backwards. I mean, I had one of those dukkha experiences where I've actually had a couple different experiences where, you know, with my spouse, where, you know, I felt like I totally was all about me and bad reactions and everything. This week, and I was like, oh my God, you know. So I apologized, and all I could do was go forward, you know. But then last night when we were out with the two new friends that we just were getting together with for the first time, I felt like I was able to have a different experience of kind of sitting back and not making it about me. And so I was relating to what you said, Kevin, about like what happens if we are like that, you know, we are like kind of not making it about ourselves and just, you know, so there was a weird sense of when the night was over of kind of an emptiness, kind of like, wow, you know, that was different, you know. Usually I talk and, you know, interact more, and I was just kind of paying more attention to everybody else. And like you said, in a way, we're giving more when we're making it less about ourselves. I don't know if you said it that way, but giving other people the space, you know, felt good, you know. So I kind of have had two different experiences this week. So kind of like that whole, will I ever get it one day, and then the next day feeling like I'm starting to get it. It's new.
Yeah, but that's just it. Yeah, some days it really feels like we're locked into the practice, and other days it's not. It seems like it's the furthest thing from our experience. But that's part of impermanence. It's part of the anatta, the not-self-characteristic, trying to assert itself over time. You were able to have a reactive experience, but it sounds like you also didn't judge yourself harshly. That's so important. Recognize that we're human beings. We're not always going to be able to fit perfectly within the Eightfold Path, but it's just a path. If you fall off the path, there it is. You get back on it. You use the term emptiness perfectly. That's how the Buddha described emptiness, meaning empty of clinging. It's not some vague, amorphous environment. We empty ourselves of clinging. And in that situation, you did not, it sounds like you consciously did not try to assert your ego self. And that's what it feels like. It feels pleasant because I'm not always trying to maintain this thing that can't be maintained. I'm just present with two new friends and a spouse. What a wonderful experience to be able to do that. Instead of think, what do I need to get out of this? How can I make myself known here?
Yeah.
Just being present. You know? Those are the practical applications. And the more you experience it, the more you're able to continue to experience it. It relates to karma, what I'm going to talk about in just a moment, too. You're laying the foundation for the next moment in your life by being mindfully present without any reaction. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you.
Thank you. Well, I can remember last week I sat here and said, okay, the Buddha says the 12 links to dependent origination. Well, I can't see them, but if he says that, you know, he says it, so that's how it is. And I couldn't see the links and, you know, the process. However, this week when I, right at the beginning of Five Clinging Aggregates, there's quotation marks from the Buddha, right at the beginning of the chapter, and you make the link from clinging, craving, back into wrong mindfulness or agitated mind, what they call it. Anyway, and I could clearly see those links. They were as clear as a bell. And I said to myself, how can it be any different? You start off in the wrong framework. You can only go to you, and I could see it as clear as day, the links. And I really sort of felt that. And then also about eye making, and hopefully not having a stronger contact with my own ego personality to diminish that. I've realised that when you decide to do something or whatever, you often say to yourself, I'll go do, you know, or I'll do this, or I'll make the bed, or I'll do this thing. And really, you're just relating back to the I, and you're just reinforcing it. You can actually think to just do things without putting that I in front of the sentence. You know, you can think, okay, I'm going, you know, do the beds or do this or do that. You don't have to put that I in front of the sentence. And I think that's a way of just softening. I won't say it diminishes. You don't get this in a heartbeat, you know. You have to sort of like work at seeing the problem.
Yeah.
And that's how I've been thinking about the problem of eye making, how I think anyway. And just sort of softening that I when I'm thinking to myself. And then right at the end of the chapter, you put in something, you linked in time. Not quite exactly say what in the sentence it was, but you linked in time in this chapter. And just recently, again, I've been thinking about time, and in a really, there really is no time. There's just the flow of the day, but there's no real time. And often in our thinking, we say, it's time to have lunch, it's time to get up, it's time to do this, it's time to do that. And again, you can just drop that time. You know, there is no time to have lunch, time to do. And those tasks that you do are not related to time in any way. When you eat is not related to time. Some things are, if you have an appointment with, you know, 10 o'clock I'm going to meet so-and-so, you agree at that point that that's the way we're going to agree to meet at that time. But in your daily life, time is not, you don't relate a lot of things back to time in your life. You know, time to do the walk. So I've been thinking about just not having that I in front of, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it. Just do it without reinforcing the I. And again, with time, just do it. And just have that flow of life without... I hope I'm making sense.
No, you're making perfect sense.
Yeah. I need to do this, I need to do that, I need to do this. Yeah.
That's taking the mundane task that we all have to do in a personal way.
Right.
Rather than
You just need to do it.
Time to wash the bathroom.
You just do it.
And when there's no you involved in that, we're getting conceptual, well, how can I do it if there's no me here? You're just not personalizing it. That's all that it means. Time has a function as far as social agreements are concerned. We all agree to come here at 8:30. I agree that at 8:30 I'm going to start a class rather than, walking here at, well, there's no me here, so I'll just get there at 3:00. But, that doesn't work. And that would, and if you think about that, that would be another establishment of an arrogant self, which happens a lot. There's a lot of, the people don't keep agreements because of, I don't want to get into that. But as far as, we talk about it up here and on retreat too, from an awakened point of view, who I am is simply a reference in relation to what's occurring in life. I don't have to continue to establish myself here. I'm here. It doesn't matter what I am doing. There's no overall importance in an individual way. What is important is to be present with my life as it unfolds. And if I happen to find myself in a situation where I'm teaching meditation classes on Saturday morning, that's what I'm doing. But it doesn't separate me or define me in any other way, except it's what I'm doing. The same as, at 3:00 this afternoon, I think I'll probably be washing the floors. Okay. If I'm sitting here thinking, I don't want to have to do it. Somebody else should be able to do it. Why can't I get a maid? Well, that's taking it all personally,
I do that all the time, John.
So stop. But that's the point. It really is these mundane details that we really get caught up on. It really is. Because we don't want to, there's things that we don't want to do. What does that mean? That's an aversion. What is that? That's a desire that something be different than it is. If I want to live in a clean house, I got to clean the floor if I'm the one responsible for it. That means that's just the way it is. The Buddha said that there's four basic needs that we need. And beyond that, we shouldn't be too concerned over anything. And it's food, shelter, clothing, and medicine when we need it. As human beings, that's all that we need. And if you think about that, for the most part, those are kind of taken care of just as a matter of living in the world and taking basic responsibility for ourselves. We don't need anything else than that. Beyond that, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't acquire things or have, a nice big house and maybe four new cars and a boat. But if we're attached to having those things in order for us to be happy or to prove how successful we are, we're making a mess of our lives. We're creating more stress for ourselves. If we find ourselves in a situation where we're living in the White House and in Florida at the same time, just to use an example, to just acknowledge that. And we don't even have to, the next word, we should be grateful for it. Well, okay, but who are you being grateful to? It's simply a situation that you find yourself in. Don't take any of it personally. And again, that gets back to what Laura was saying, what we've all been talking about. There's nothing to take personal. Why? Because there's nothing personal. A confused and deluded mind takes everything personal, just the opposite of what the Buddha is saying.
What I like is that those are such nice, concrete, like a baby step for me. Okay, I don't have to make in my bed. It's a good example. Mm. Or doing the dishes about me, I like that because it's something I can grasp onto and work on.
Again, it's those mundane things that they just seem to get in the way of seeing what's really here. I live alone. I live in Bodhi's house, in my dog's house. But he doesn't do anything except be extremely cute.
And shed.
So he doesn't. Oh, he's one of those kind of dogs. I'm just to make the point. If I want to live in a relatively clean house with stuff in order, I have to do it. He's not going to do it. I have to do it. But why take it personally? And why, and if the floor doesn't get swept this week, okay, you know, I'm not going to take that personally either. Please don't come over to my house today. It's not the grand questions that we're trying to answer, and it's not the biggest problems in life that we're trying to solve. That's part of dukkha occurs. Whatever's going on in the world, this relates a little bit to my talk, if I ever get to it. There's such a thing as worldly causes and conditions. There are always going to be such a thing as worldly causes and conditions. And I'm talking about all the struggles, you know, the big things like earthquakes and floods and maybe even nuclear annihilation, to minor things like being stuck in traffic or maybe being late for a meditation class or a doctor's appointment or for seeing our friend or maybe paying the mortgage or the rent when we don't have quite enough money. That's all part of worldly causes and conditions. There's nothing we can do about that. That's part of living in the world. This relates to karma and rebirth. But it's the mundane things that we really get caught up in. And sometimes we'll take worldly causes and conditions so we don't have to focus on the mundane problems, meaning, let me lose my mind over an election. Rather than face what's going on, what's the most important thing? It's me being attached to my life being different than it is. That's taking it personal. What's occurring is what's occurring. If I want to change something in meaning direction of my life, then I have to do something meaningful and probably different than I've been doing to change it. There's the Eightfold Path. So before I'm just about into karma and rebirth, but before I do that, any questions about these last 2 weeks, dependent origination or five clinging aggregates?
You said something to add. I hope it'll add to it in the beginning reading that I'm doing. You know, there are quotations from the Buddha, and he will say, or he's quoted as saying, what I read is, you can say, I am sitting, I am standing, I am going, I am lying down. And you can extend that to, I am making the bed, or whatever. But you can still be that I.
Yep.
And then you can say, I am breathing in, I am breathing out. But it's the why me. That's, I think, what it is. It's like, why do I have to make the bed? Why do I have
yeah.
to be the one?
That's taking it personally.
Why? Yeah, that's the taking it personally. So there is still the I,
yep.
I guess, but it's just not taking it personally.
It really comes down to that. That's one of the big paradoxes that are that later developed Buddhist schools have attempted to address, and usually they address it in the way that says there's no such thing as a self. And they relate emptiness to that. We're all chasing this understanding of vast emptiness where there's no self in that. It's not what the Buddha taught. You know, it almost sounds... It's taught, I think, in some speculation, to reconcile a misunderstanding of what really constitutes a self in the Buddha's terms of anatta. The Buddha used that term to simply say that what you think of as a self is not a self. Let go of the views. It's the views that are confusing you. When Vachagoda used to come and argue with the Buddha about these grand things, the Buddha would say, it's your questions that are confusing you, Vachi. Let go of the questions. It's our questions. It's our self-referential views that create the confusion, delusion, and suffering. When you let go of the views, what's left? Me meditating. But it's not me meditating correctly or long enough or for any other reason except to deepen concentration. When I'm cleaning the rug or whatever else I'm doing, it's just doing it because it's what's in front of me to do. But there's no self-identification attached to it. It's just a reference point in what's occurring. So when I'm meditating, yes, I'm aware that this is me meditating. Period. Not meditating with an identity around it or with a need for it to be any different than just meditating. There's a significant but often sometimes subtle difference there. But we can't one of the reasons why these teachings are here, including the five clinging aggregates, is to explain that process of the difference between me meditating and me meditating. You know, one has a clinging view attached to it, a self-establishing view, and one is simply an acknowledgement of what's occurring. It is. It's subtle. Some people can see that very clearly. Kandana heard the Buddha's teachings, and right there, he understood that. When he said all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation, that's really what he was talking about. He was talking about external conditions. What really was really referring to, what he really understood, is his own contributions to suffering from conditioned mind. His own conditioned mind. All conditioned things, meaning his own conditioned thoughts that arise, are subject to cessation. And as Lao Tzu said, once you recognize the impermanence of all things, you'll let go of everything. Why hold on to anything that's impermanent? Why hold on to a moldy piece of bologna? You know, it's just going to get worse. Let it go. It's impermanent. Why hold on to a moldy thought that's causing confusion and suffering? Let it go. It's an impermanent thought. The problem is that I've created an identity over this moldy thought, and now I have to hold on to it because it's me. And if I let go of it, what happens to me? Hopefully a fresher thought comes in. So that relates to, again, any questions or comments before we... And again, it's gotten a little bit late in the day. I won't rush through this, but you're going to read this anyway. So just a quote from the Buddha relating to karma. I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions. I am born of my actions and related through my actions. Related to what? Related to the continuity of the establishment of self. My actions will determine the fortune or misfortune in my life. So the Buddha taught karma, contrary to the way that karma was portrayed up until that point, but he used the term because that was a common term that people use. The reason why I'm saying that is one of the reasons why karma has either been misinterpreted or dismissed is there's some so-called Buddhist scholars that will say the Buddha only taught karma. Karma is not an important teaching. The Buddha only referenced it because everybody else was talking about it. Of course, why did he say anything else then? You know, he used it in a completely different term. The word karma at the time was rooted in the Vedas, which are the precursor to modern Hinduism, and there's a lot of different types of intricacies about karma and how karma is something that is manipulated by outside forces that vaguely relate to your behavior, but there's almost a compounding effect, which is not what it is. And that relates to the modern application of karma. Karma is often the pop usage of karma, is that karma is kind of like this vague punishment that, you know, and if you're having a rough day, it's because you're walking under this dark cloud of karma. Or the other thing is that if something really good happens to you, it's while you're being blessed with good karma. It's none of those things. And of course, the Buddha says it relates to our actions. And it's our actions that determine our karma. It has nothing to do with our position in life or some outside force. It's directly related to our karma. So karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional acts, and that word intentional is important, moderated by the present level of our consciousness or our mindfulness. And if our present level of mindfulness is framed by the Eightfold Path, then we will incline our karma towards awakening and away from further confusion, delusion, and suffering. And if not, our karma will simply be the constant unfolding of actions rooted in ignorance. And actions rooted in ignorance can have an intention, can't they? The reason why I'm making that distinction is, this is really one of the more hurtful teachings that have developed out of a misunderstanding. And I think you probably all heard things like there's a devastating flood somewhere, and someone somewhere will say, boy, what awful karma those people have. That's such a vicious and hurtful thing to say. It has nothing to do with individual karma. In that situation where people's karma would be reinforced is reacting in a negative way to their situation. But worldly causes and conditions such as floods or earthquakes or violence on the street or, to some people, disappointing presidential elections, those aren't karma, but our reaction to it will increase or diminish our karma, or lack of reaction to it. Is that clear? So when we have developed the Eightfold Path and our minds are well concentrated, this doesn't mean a fully awakened human being, but we've developed the path well enough to be mindful of it, like Laura was describing this morning. And something occurs, such as children watching TV, when I'd rather they don't. my reaction could be to throw a shoe into the TV. I'm going to start creating additional karma, meaning an upset in my life and other people's lives. Or I can remain calm, practice restraint, and maybe say something like, you know, this might be not be the best thing for you. And now I'm contributing to, my action is now contributing towards awakening because I'm maintaining a peaceful and calm mind for myself and, coincidentally, everyone else around me. My actions, I'm born of my actions. Each moment holds the potential to what I will give birth to in the next moment. If it's rooted in refined mindfulness, then my next moment will be peaceful and it will continue to incline my mind towards awakening. If I react from a conditioned point of view, I'm simply furthering, just to use the word, negative karma or hurtful karma or unskillful karma. That's what my next moment will be like because of what decisions and choices and responses I'm making in this moment. If my interaction with the world is well framed in that refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, I will continue towards awakening. If my actions are rooted in conditioned thinking, which itself is rooted in ignorance, I can only give birth to another ignorant moment. And an ongoing series of ignorant moments, unless something happens to interrupt that thinking. The method of meditation that we use that deepens concentration directly interrupts our karma because it interrupts our conditioned thinking. Even if it's just for that moment when we come back to the sensation of breathing, and the next moment we're thinking about having to clean the rug this afternoon, come back to the sensation of breathing. We're interrupting conditioned thinking. We're interrupting karma. We're interrupting the ongoing process of dukkha. And we're bringing our minds back into this present moment. And it is in this present, and I'm not talking about a fixed present moment. There's no such thing. We're bringing ourselves back into a life rooted in the becoming of awakening, rather than becoming more confused, deluded, and suffering. And that relates to the teachings on rebirth. The Buddha taught a path for awakening in this human life. When he awakened, there's a picture, it's not there. Most of the pictures of the Buddha's awakening are him sitting here with his left hand up, and I won't get into, and he's touching the ground with his right finger. And what he's signifying is that he has overcome the world, meaning he has emptied himself of the world. He's emptied himself of clinging to the world. I have overcome the world. And then he says, it's a long speech, not a long speech, but I won't give the whole thing. He says, for me, there will be no more future rebirth. There is nothing further for me in this world. I have lived, usually the word is holy life. I like to use the word integrated life. I have lived the integrated life. There is nothing further for me in the world. What does that mean? For one thing, it does mean that he will no longer, this entity, Siddhartha Gautama, will not be born again in the future because there's nothing driving future rebirth. But what's most important is there's nothing left in him that can drive a future next moment birth of ignorance. That's the most important teaching on rebirth, karma and rebirth. Karma is a present moment unfolding of our past intentional actions modified by the present level of our refined mindfulness. And if my mindfulness is refined enough, that I am now a fully mature, fully awakened human being, I will no longer contribute to further ignorance and suffering. In a way, I have brought karma to cessation, which means that I will no longer give birth in the next moment to suffering, and I will no longer give birth to a future life of suffering. I have ended that ongoing process. One of the reasons why we get hung up on, or maybe that's where these teachings came about too, that from a physical life through a period of death to a future rebirth, is we don't understand that that process is going on each moment in our lives. It happens so quickly and so imperceptibly that we don't realize that each moment I'm giving birth to a new me. Physiologically, Kevin would know this probably better than all of us. Physiologically, we know that each moment we are giving birth to millions and millions of cells, and millions of cells are dying off. we know that over the course of approximately 7 years, each cell in our body will be replaced by a new cell. In a very real sense, we are new people each moment because of that ongoing process. Included in that ongoing process is, in dependent origination, in other words, we talk about nama rupa. Nama means identification with a form. In that form is ongoing consciousness. It's part of that. It's part of that ongoing process of becoming. So our thoughts, when well refined, are in this vehicle that we're experiencing in our life, and that thought, a fresh and mindful thought, gives birth to a new karma, a new way of living in the world each moment. And if you just think about the process of coming across the Buddhist teachings, develop a little bit of understanding, how much different your experience in the world is. That's a new birth. And that's the kind of birth that the Buddha was talking about. He was not concerned. He didn't say that there's no such thing as physical reincarnation. But he basically said, don't worry about that. Because if you get caught up on your future birth, you're missing your life right now. And here is a path that you can learn how to live your life each moment as fully and completely and mindfully as you can. And then each moment will be a mindful moment, meaning a mindful moment of that framed by the Eightfold Path. And that's the most important take on birth. What am I going to give birth to in the next moment? Not so much what am I going to give, what's going to happen in the future birth. Many of the later developed Buddhist schools talk about being stuck in this endless life of physical birth, physical suffering, another physical birth, and ongoing. And it's often portrayed as for endless eons, endless lifetimes, we're stuck in this ongoing process. But if you start right now and you do all the right things and you do all the right rituals, there's even Buddhist schools that say that if there's this one particular chant, if you keep this chant going constantly, and if it's on your lips when you die, when you die, you will be instantly transplanted to this place. I won't use the word because I don't want to offend people. You'll be taken to this type of Buddhist heaven where you'll be taken care of forever by this particular Buddha. Well, okay, but what does that do for me now? And it doesn't do, saying that chant or doing any other ritual or taking on any other belief that is focused on what I may attain in the future. What did I just say? What I may attain in the future. It's all a much more subtle aspect of continued eye-making. And it's not something that the Buddha taught. I'm not concerned right now about what I'm going to become 300 lifetimes from now. And think about that. How can we even have that experience in the present moment? The Buddha taught everything he taught could be experienced. What's most important to me right now? What's going to happen in the next moment? This is where I'm living my life. This is where I have my human life. And I don't care if I have an endless series of human lives going back eons and into future eons. Even if I do, I can't have the experience of it. Even if I do, what I want is to find a way to have lasting peace and happiness in my life. That's what that was the skillful desire I was born with, and we were all born with it. It's what the Buddha was trying to reconcile even when he was a little boy, because you couldn't relate it to his palace life and then when he left the palace grounds. That desire for peace and happiness didn't seem to fit into what was occurring in the world. And it doesn't. Why? Because of the first noble truth, dukkha occurs. We can never establish permanent personal happiness in an ever-changing world that's subject to suffering. But what we can do is stop insisting and stop taking things so personal, and live our life as life occurs, free of a reactive mind. How do we do it? Through the Eightfold Path and the deep concentration of meditation. And then we can cease our unskillful karma, develop something called skillful karma, and give birth in this moment to the life that we all want to live, free of the entanglements of worldly causes and conditions. And what does it look like when we've done that? doesn't look any different than it did before, except we might have our shoulders might be a little lower, probably have a smile on our face more than we did. Mm-hmm. We'll be much more pleasant with ourselves and others. But what's most importantly was we will have realized that true gem of the Dhamma, lasting peace and happiness. It's what the Buddha set out to discover and teach, and that's all that he ever taught. But it's really the most valuable thing anybody could achieve, isn't it? Because then no matter what occurs, first noble truth, dukkha occurs, no matter what dukkha occurs, we'll be able to maintain our peace and happiness. The ever-changing vagaries of life won't have any effect on us anymore. We'll be able to respond in an immediate and direct and meaningful way while maintaining our peacefulness and happiness. So that's the teachings on karma and rebirth. Yes, I was going to ask.
I've never really thought very much about my next life, and nor have I thought about all the lives that I've had previous to here. Is that because I'm blinded with my sense of I at the moment, that I can't think of myself in another life prior to here? To this one, and I can't think of myself in the next life, assuming I don't awaken. Is that because I'm just stuck? Because I just personally, I think when you're dead, you know,
that's your belief.
Going on, you know, you're dead, and that's kind of how I think.
That's a more realistic look at it, again, because even if there is going to be a future life, this is the one that's most important. So that really depends on what you've been, what has occurred in your life to condition your thinking. So if you were brought up in a Tibetan Buddhist household, I'm not putting Tibetan Buddhist down,
okay,
you would have been indoctrinated into this idea, and even other Buddhist schools, and most religions teach that in some way, you know. Christianity teaches the next life is either going to be, it's either going to be good or bad. You got one choice or the other. There's other traditions that do teach future lives. The norm is that there is something after death, and it's usually a type of a heaven or a type of hell. And again, even that idea of an infinite number of future births to the way that the Buddha taught, that process is an ongoing expression of hell. Because remember, dukkha occurs. It's in this world that dukkha occurs. No matter what occurs, there's always going to be dukkha in the world. Why do you want to keep coming back here? Or any other realm? But so you don't have those thoughts, not because of conceit. You just haven't had a conditioned mind. You're lucky. You know? So it's best to let go of any of those thoughts, and because not to get into speculation of whether it's true or not, it's not helpful. What is helpful is what's occurring in my life right now, and what do I need to do to awaken? When the Buddha passed, he said, impermanence and decay is relentless. Strive diligently for your own awakening. This was right after he was asked a question from Ananda, saying, You're going. What should we do? Give us your teaching. And he said, I'm not like a teacher with a closed fist. I've held nothing back. I've given you everything you need. Impermanence and decay is relentless. Strive diligently for your own awakening. For your own awakening. He didn't say, when I'm gone, you know, create statues of me and pray to me, because if you're lucky, I'll give you awakening. Strive diligently for your own. I've given you. Here's the path to your own awakening. Nowhere in his teachings did he say there's no such thing as disincarnate beings. He said that they are the same as us in relation. But he also taught that disincarnate beings are best viewed as aspects of our own consciousness. And the same thing with these notions that we can't experience, such as a future birth or endless rebirths. They're not important to what's occurring right now. What's occurring right now is what's the quality of my mindfulness, and how can I develop awakening as quickly as possible? it points back to what Debbie was talking, right effort. It's up to us to put the effort in. But if we find that you can all even say that it's your karma or own conditioned thinking, which are really closely related, that your conditioned thinking or your karma got you out of practice for a little while, don't let that cause a harsh judgment in your mind. Just come back to practice. You know, again, the framework of the Eightfold Path is the way of ending karma and ending all types of challenging rebirth. Take to the Dhamma and awaken. Again, so any, a little bit long class, sorry. Any questions? So you'll study karma and rebirth, and we'll talk about it next week. But notice, again, how these teachings in this chapter on karma and rebirth relates to the Four Noble Truths. That's the most important thing. How does it relate to suffering? How does it relate to craving and clinging? How does craving and clinging contribute to our karma, and what are we giving birth to in each moment? All right, let's finish with the Buddha's words on metta. So gently close your eyes, find your relaxed meditative posture, and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of a fully awake and fully mature human being. These are the Buddha's words from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.